Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is Mr. Spencer Crystal Williams.
What?
I don't even know
what that's in reference to.
I was trying to make a reference to like the crystals that she jumps on in
those
the movie.
Those are minerals.
You know what? Spencer, thank you for joining the show.
Yeah, hey, I'm here.
He's here, and also with us, speaking of which, as you just heard, is intern slash part-timer slash coffee bringer who brings no coffee slash stenographer Amy.
Yes.
Who is here to talk with us about the latest Pixar film coming out of the House of Mouse, and that is Elemental. So we'll dive deep into that film, talk about what we thought about it, and honestly get into the nitty-gritty, because to be honest, I feel like this movie was a little bit of a surprise, and so we will be surprising you with our thoughts. But before we go any deeper, Spencer, why don't you give us some opening credits?
Tune in each and every Thursday morning.
Thursday!
It's on Thursday,
Amy,
not Wednesday.
It's on Thursday.
Thursday mornings from now on all your favorite stream platforms.
We need Logan back for that sound.
We just need to get him to record that. And no, you can also tune in at our website at filmlosophers.com.
We threw Spencer off.
Yeah, you did. Also, connect with us on the social pages at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101.
That's right. You can check us out all over our the websites, the interwebs, over at our website at filmlosophers.com, where we have allegedly over 300 episodes, everything ranging from action, anime, comedy, Transformers, which Spencer is a huge fan of them movies. You can check us out over at our website. If you're looking for it, we got it. Head on over, filmlosophers.com. You can also check us out wherever podcasts are streaming, and that's iTunes, Google Play, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Stitcher, Player FM, Pandora, TuneIn, iHeart. You can tune into your heart stars on any one of those platforms. Look us up at The Filmlosophers. Give us a follow. Give us a subscribe. Let us know you're listening. We want to know your feedback. Give us a comment in the comment section below. Also, you can give us a 5-star review because we've earned it.
We have after Transformers.
Yes, we actually have on that. Yeah. Well, you said that
at the beginning of that episode.
At the beginning of that episode, you didn't deserve it. But this, after coming through it, much like Eddie went through the Sharknado again.
I feel like mine was worse.
No.
Well, no. But here's why.
You didn't have
any hope. Okay, you knew Sharknado was going to be bad going into it. There was a glimmer of hope at the beginning.
And I saw it a second time, the entire franchise.
I cannot condone that.
But you also had a partner over here who's like, Spencer, I hear you, and that junior filmlosopher pulled it out.
Also, I want to just throw this out there. Logan, if you're listening, you did a great job, buddy.
Yeah.
You got me through that episode.
If you're wondering what we're talking about episode 361, where we talk about Transformers Rise of the Beast. So check out that episode if you want to hear Spencer lose his cool. We are going to be talking about today's episode, which is Elemental, the latest out of Pixar and, like I said, the House of Mouse. But before we do, we wanted to kind of cover some information regarding the podcast community. And it is a little bit of a somber news, but we do want to report that a great podcaster and member of not only the podcast community, but the comic book community, as well as the Sacramento Kings fandom community, has passed away. Curtis Fisher, aka Skip and Tosh, if you're more familiar with his online moniker, or one of the founding members of the Capeless Crusaders, did pass away this last Monday. Last Friday, after a very lengthy battle with colon cancer. Curtis was a friend of the show. He never got the chance to be on, but out of all of us here, Spencer really didn't get a chance to really get to know him well enough. Mm-hmm. However, Amy and I both had extensive time spent with Curtis. Mm-hmm. Amy, whose original podcast is The Capeless Crusaders, spent a lot of time That's where you started.
I actually started on Cracking the Vault, but I ended up meeting everybody for the Capeless Crusaders with, from a crossover.
How dare you get her lore wrong?
So yeah, I'm almost to 10 years of podcasting.
Oh, happy birthday.
So, yes.
So being on Capeless Crusaders, Capeless Crusaders, which we had one of the other founding members on this show, not too long ago, talking about, we had him on an episode for,
it was two or three ago, and I can't remember. I'm sorry, Doc, but I got distracted because of the conversation we had afterwards when we were talking.
True. We had a great conversation with David Doc Barry here on the show, and I'm pretty sure if someone looks it up, we can find it. Doc, who was a founding member, also shared a lot of great memories with Curtis. Amy, who has been on that episode, has been on that show as well, spent a lot of time and had a lot of great memories with Curtis. Myself, when Curtis transitioned over to the founding podcast that I was a part of, Video Game Bang, hosted by Corey Vincent, as well as David Webb and Emma Skies, I got a lot of opportunities to sit across from the man, talk comic books, talk Sacramento Kings, talk everything nerdy, everything about music, everything about comics, everything that this man was a plethora of knowledge about. He was willing to share and able to speak on many aspects, whether if it was all genres of music, his taste in basketball, or his taste in comics.
Or taste in gaming. That was the other part that really kind of synced him up with the VGB community, was because he had a deep and abiding passion for Smash Brothers as well as Street Fighter, and that was competitive and uncompetitively. So
non-competitive.
Yes. By the way, the episode that we had Doc on for most recently was Less Than 355, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, I Am Raccoon.
There you go. So to say that his presence will be missed is an understatement. Unfortunately, Curtis left a very large hole when he left, and like I said, he was a massive part of that community, of all communities. When you're in a tight-knit group such as the podcasting communities in a small city, and by small city I mean the arena of like other podcasters within the city, when you're in that kind of a small community, you just kind of get to know a lot of different people and all of all walks of life. And Curtis was one of those types of people who made an effort to get to know everybody and truly be their friend. He'll be sorely missed. I know Nerdon, who has another founding member, or one of the main members from Capeless Crusaders, Tom, they actually did a conversation about him the other day on one of their live streams. And we didn't want to miss an opportunity to say, you know, Curtis, you know, we are thankful for the time we had, and we wish you on good journey, because wherever he goes from here, you know, we wish that he goes well. And if you are the praying type who is listening, by all means, lift his family up, keep them in prayer. Yeah. He has two daughters. He has a mom who will miss him dearly. Family who will miss him dearly, and of course, friends who will miss him dearly. Also, be on the lookout. If you're a fan of the show or you're a fan of Video Game Bang, we will be doing a tribute show in the near future. I am coordinating that with Corey Vincent so that we can kind of pull together those who remember him the best and just honor the man. So,
yeah, and I know speaking for the Capeless Crusaders, even coming in later to the game, the as affectionately dubbed them, the six OG from the fruit stand, because they all worked for the fruit stand.
For Apple.
But
for
they the can't Apple say store. Apple.
We they just all worked did.
For fruit stand. Like,
none
that
of
was,
us work for
but
Apple.
But we just don't. Did. But that's what they would say. So speaking for that, I know they would definitely love to join in that and give any and all stories, anecdotal or otherwise, as well as surprise gifts that I don't think everybody knew that Curtis had in his back pocket.
Yeah. If you're not aware, Curtis was, when he was with the Capeless Crusaders, was one of the production people as well
he
as
was
on,
the production
he, as well as the one of the hosts. So between him and I, we talked a lot of tech. We talked a lot of, you know, planning out and things of that sort. And of course, tons and tons and tons of nerdy stuff. So you will be missed. And we, like I said, we wish you on a good journey. Yeah. But switching gears, we are transitioning over into our conversation of the evening. And that is the latest drop from Pixar. If you've been under a rock, no pun intended, this movie did drop a few weeks ago, but we are talking about it today, and that is Pixar's Elemental. This movie came as a surprise to all of us, as it didn't get a lot of attention pertaining to promotion and commercials, trailers, diving into the bigger story. It seemed like it was just based on the very surface area of the movie. And that was unfortunate, because we almost missed out on this. But I'm glad
I refuse to miss out on this. Let us establish that when it said Pixar, I went, it was that tell me how to jump. How the answer is how high, sir? I am showing up for Pixar, whether it is a dud or not, and then we will discuss.
Well, so far they basically have like an auto add to our list.
Yeah,
true. So, before we go any forward, Spencer, give us that official synopsis goodness.
In a city where fire, water, land, and air residents live together, a fiery young woman and a go-with-the-flow guy are about to discover something elemental. How much they actually have in common. This is the lamest one I've read to date.
You're welcome. I pulled that from somewhere. Directed by Peter Son, with Pete Docter serving as the executive producer, the film features the voices of Leia Lewis, Mamadou Athi, Ronnie Del Carmen, Sheila Ami, Wendy McLendon Covey, and Catherine O'Hara.
Hey.
Out of all those names, Catherine O'Hara was the easiest. Quick couple pieces of information. This film is based on director Peter Son's life with his parents immigrating to the USA from Korea, not speaking a word of English, and settling into the Bronx. San's family also opened up a grocery store named San's Fruits and Vegetables, similar to Ember's family in the film. Another key piece of information, Pixar had to actually upgrade and buy more computers for Elemental. There is over 151,000 cores in use for this film in three large rooms on the Pixar campus. For perspective, Toy Story back in 1995 had 294 cores, Monsters, Inc. in 2001 had 672 cores, and Finding Nemo in 2003 had 923 cores. So, even with all these movies put together, they still don't amount to the amount of core processors this particular film required, which is a lot. I've been on that campus, and if it utilized three large rooms on that Pixar campus, those are large rooms. Last piece of information, Pixar. This is actually Pixar's first original film to be released directly to theaters in 3 years since the COVID-19 pandemic, where the last three original Pixar films, such as Soul from 2020, Luca in 2021, and Turning Red in 2022, had only premiered directly to Disney+, which we have talked about at length, about that whole management choice pertaining to only releasing them on Disney+. So for this to be their first film, I don't know if I'm excited about it pertaining to, you know, it being the first one when there was a lot of other contenders prior to that. Mm-hmm. But I still stand by my statement that I feel like Pixar will get smart one of these days and actually consider separating from the House of Mouse.
Maybe.
But
I don't even know if they can legally do that.
Well, that's a question for lawyers, and I do not have that in my repertoire of stenography.
I mean, honestly, considering like everything's done by contract, there's got to be a limitation on that contract somewhere.
That's there. It's
I mean, Disney. we're not doing what.
Do we need to look to what happened to Florida?
I was just going to say, I don't know if there's any clause pertaining to what's his name?
Santa Claus, King Charles.
It's the
royalty clause or whatever it is. That's also the thing, is like, if you want to renew a trademark, what do? You make a remake.
Yeah, true. So we're going to be diving into this film, and we're going to be talking about spoilers, as this film has already been in theaters 2 weeks or 3 weeks.
Oh my gosh, I think it's been maybe two.
Maybe
two. I'm thinking it's got to be two. It'll be three by the time this comes out. So maybe we're less than a month.
We are less than a month. Yeah, everyone's run into the computers. June 16th, so 2 weeks.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, there you go.
So we're going to be talking about spoilers. So this is your first, last, and only warning for spoiler alert. You have been warned. Talking about this movie, so I do have to emphasize, I was not considering this to be any kind of exponential movie of any kind, anything that would really have any impact. I felt like this was like Disney's way to be like, oh, fine, we'll give you one and we'll throw this one out there. Like, it didn't look like it was going to be a lot. It didn't look like it was going to have any substantial story. It looked like it was going to be a dud.
Can I say something? I have no idea where this even came from me, but I had the hardest time remembering this was from Pixar, because like I kept associating it with DreamWorks for some reason, like right up until the point I actually saw this.
Wow.
I don't know. I was just not expecting mostly anything from this movie.
Well, to be honest, I mean, first off, other than Catherine O'Hara, there's nobody known in this film. The only thing notable about this film is that Peter Son is directing it. Mm. And if you're familiar with Peter Son's work, he was also the director for The Good Dinosaur.
Which neither of you saw.
And she points it out every time.
Yeah, yes,
every
I time. Do. I do.
He I'm going to surprise watch that one of these times.
And then I'm going to go, we're going to have a conversation. You're going to go, Amy, I know what I saw. He was also the director of the 2008 or 2009 short, Partly Cloudy. Mm-hmm. He's the voice of Emil from Ratatouille. He's the voice of Socks in Lightyear. He's also the character design for Russell in Up, as well as Squishy in Monsters University.
So let's talk expectations, because like I said, we didn't there wasn't much to go off of in the trailer, and to be quite frank, I wasn't sure this was going to be anything worth seeing. So let's talk expectations, starting with Amy. What were you expecting going into the film?
Because this had such limited kind of exposure for me, and we can actually, I know Spencer and I briefly touched on it, on the different trailers that we saw and how they were leaning towards things. I didn't really know what to expect, because the initial vibes were kind of like fish out of what I saw in the trailers were fish out of water, new city, more immigrant story based, trying to get around in the world.
You got that from the trailer?
Yeah, actually I did.
I don't think she did. But go ahead, keep going.
Okay. But
then, that's what she told me.
But then and then we also had the juxtaposition of, I was like, why does this feel a little bit like Zootopia? So I didn't know where I was falling on that. So my expectations were like, I don't know what to expect. We'll try it.
Okay. Spencer.
Yeah. So basically what I said earlier, and then watching the trailer, I kind of just was like, oh, it's a love story between opposite elements. Okay. I still don't know if this is going to be worth anything, but I'm here for you, Pixar. We'll see where you're going.
I'm here for you, Pixar.
Like you made Up sad within 10 minutes. So I'm sure you can pull out a real showstopper if you really want to.
True.
What about you, Ed?
I'm going to be completely honest. My expectations were very minimal. Based on the trailers that I saw, here's the thing. I took the expectations I had based off of the trailer into the movie. Now, talking to other critics, you know, that I've worked with, who had seen a like advanced screening for the film, especially some of them being of Asian descent, a lot of them were like, oh my gosh, this was phenomenal. This was wonderful. This was, you know, this story was so great. And this and that. And I'm like, why? You know, what about it made you so, you know, attached to this film? And a lot of them were like, it's relatable. You know, it's definitely, you know, it's got the, you know, it's the immigrant story. I didn't want to take any of that into account coming into the film, because I wanted to base it off of what was promoted. What was part of their marketing plan? Like, this film was honestly, I felt, my personal opinion, marketed very lightly. This movie didn't get a lot of attention on, you know, in the trailer aspect. It didn't get a lot of information giving, you know, the origins of the story until you started seeing like press junkets, and until you started seeing, you know, information coming out after the fact, after people saw it. And I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to take someone's after the fact thought and say, okay, this is my expectation going in. I wanted to go on with the mindset that if I was some Joe off the street somebody who was not, you know, savvy to having access to people that I know in the industry, what would be my expectation going into the film? And based on their marketing, there wasn't a lot. Like, unfortunately, I was going in with the fact that this movie has elements that are people, and there's an element who is fire, and there's an element who is water, who are the main characters. That's it. That was all I got. So it was a little minimal in terms of expectations, but once we saw the film, that definitively changed, and we'll go ahead and go into first impressions, starting with Amy.
I like this, and I like this a lot, and I'm going to talk about it later, but I liked it a lot. Okay. I can't, like, if I'm going to talk first impressions, I'm going to start gushing. So I liked it a lot.
So she has no self-control. Go ahead, Spencer.
Okay, so I'm saying at the beginning that, like, oh, I was like, oh, it's a love story. To be slapped in the face with, like, no, it's an immigrant story. I was like, oh, this is interesting now. Like, this isn't what I was sold. So I'm here for it. So I was like, I was very into being lied to by Disney this time.
There you go. Hey. I mean, even if once they get it right, I mean, hey, you know. But I have to second Spencer's thought here, because it's like I went into thinking it was just about elements. You would assume, because there's a male, you know, character and a female character, that Pixar is going to take an attempt to creating another love story. And sure enough, they created a story that really resonated. And it really did speak on not just the aspect of opposites attract, but also in the aspect of, you know, the love of family, the love of people who come from different places, the love of individuals who view love in a different way, in terms of maybe sometimes it's not by saying it, but sometimes it's by showing it. Sometimes it's by expressing it in the small way. Sometimes it's expressing it in the big ways. And it's all still considered love, you know, even in different interpretations. To be frank, I was blown away by this movie. I absolutely consider this film one of the best of the year so far. And we'll get into reasons why. But let's talk right out the gates, actors, performers. Mm-hmm. Were there any standout performances that you guys saw?
I can honestly say Athey or Athey. I cannot pronounce your first name. Mamudo. I cannot pronounce his name and I feel really bad, but his last name is...
Oh, Mamudo Athey.
Okay, so I didn't write. As Wade... he was a delight vocally to listen to. The ticks, the turns of the character and what he does vocally are matched on screen. He has a kind, he, for, because we are personifying elements.
And we're not personifying elephants. So.
No, elements. He does create that flow, the gentleness. There's space between the way things are presented that aren't breathy, but they build and they move in such an organically natural way that it flows.
Is it PC to say that his voice is sincerely perfect for the role, in not only personifying water, you know, the element water, but also making it non-descriptive in terms of, like, wherever he, you know, whatever descent he may come from, pertaining to, you know, he doesn't have a gruff accent going in this direction. He doesn't have an overly soft accent going in this direction. Like, his voice was just very neutral for the role.
Well, and I think that's probably a testament to these, to everybody as a whole, that there's not really a lot of emphasis identifiers on culture, save for like Ember's family, where it's supposed to be apparent. And even with Ember, it's not that apparent. And when you look at the voice actors themselves, you would not think the characters they play are, you know, representative of who they are in real life. And I think that's a testament to not only the way that the story is designed, but the way that they perform. And it's so refreshing for me. It's a terrible water joke. Wow. Because it's when people do a voice acting job and they do it well, it engulfs you and you can't let go. I'm sorry. I couldn't find. Encompassing, engulfing.
The mark of a great voice actor is somebody who disappears into the role. And I feel like for this role,
Keegan Michael Key was the one that I could think of right off the jump.
Mm-hmm. As she takes a drink and you know. And to say that this actor completely disappeared into the role of a personified water element is to really undersell it, because Mamoudou does a great job of just creating this character that is neutral to the point to where he sees all the subtle nuances of the other characters, and it's expressed so easily by this character. By his character. If you're not familiar, by the way, of this actor, he's the one who played the somewhat guide or assistant in Jurassic World Dominion.
Is that the second one?
The third one. The one who like helps Dr. Grant and them get away.
Oh, I liked him in that. Okay, yeah. That part, I'm like, yay, I liked him in that. So yeah, I think for this, he was one of my big highlights. And then the other person that I do want to give props, and I don't even have them up. Their last name, I believe, is Carmen. Did I do it right?
Ronnie Del Carmen?
Yeah, who plays
Bernie,
Bernie. They elementalized his name to be Bernie, even though he has this beautiful, long name. He was the perfect balance of gruff, loving father. And there was these spots of encouragement and drive. And he made it easy to see and to hear and to experience a dad who is like, I came just looking for a better place to raise you. And I am willing to do everything and anything and working myself to the end so that you can have a better life. And he was like, oh, he was a really good dad.
He really was. And honestly, prior to this, he worked in the background, if you will, for most other films. He was he was part of the art department for Up. He was also part of the art department.
He's in Pixar Town?
Yeah. He was the abstract thought mind worker in Inside Out. He's also worked in other things. He was a story artist on Coco, a story artist for Monsters U. Storyboard artist for Ratatouille. He was even a storyboard artist for Shrek.
Hey, that's kind of cool. I'm not going to lie.
The fact that he is playing a character that, number one, it felt supernatural for the character role that he was playing. It didn't feel like it was a forced, you know, kind of character. He felt like an older immigrant father.
Yeah.
He felt like it was somebody you could distinguishly recognize as somebody you may have met walking into a bodega or walking into a corner store or walking into a business that is family owned from an immigrant family. Mm-hmm. It definitely worked. Mm-hmm. And I felt like Ronnie did an absolute wonderful job in that. Spencer, was there anybody else you wanted to highlight?
No, those are the two that I would have
gone. I'm so sorry. Fine,
because they were both delightful and I love
Spencer's kicking the table underneath. So just,
that's why I keep looking down at my toes.
I mean, let's be honest. Leia Lewis sells the role for Ember. Yeah. I feel like this particular individual, this voice actress, did a phenomenal job playing the individual who wants to make her family proud, but also has goals of her own. Mm-hmm. And it's not exactly black and white like that. The way the film plays out, she goes through these crises of conscience where moments she is questioning herself. She's questioning the directions she's taking. She's even questioning her own love towards people based on, you know, this mentality that she needs to honor her father by continuing the wishes that she feels her father is bestowing upon her. Mm-hmm. And you get such a sincere performance from Leia that it's like you would honestly feel like this actress has been through this before. She is really great as the character. She really does well in all the animated portions in terms of her vocal work, you know, from the angry outbursts she has to the soft moments. I feel like those soft moments really do highlight her ability as a voice actress. There's a scene in the film where she is sitting on the beach and she is earnestly being transparent and being completely sincere, talking about how she doesn't want to fail her family and she wants to also be happy in the same aspect. And it is a masterful effort on the art department and the people behind the scenes who create this CG work to make this scene happen, because that scene just plays out so beautifully. And a lot of the earnest scenes that she has when she's, you know, either pleading for her father's shop or she's being sincere with Wade, like all these moments really do resonate for me. Of course, we can't overlook, you know, the great and wonderful Catherine O'Hara as Brooke, who is Wade's mom, who plays a wonderful mom and wonderful character in the film. We don't get a lot of her, but the amount we do get, I just feel like Catherine O'Hara has been pitted ever since the very beginning of her career, like with Beetlejuice and all that. She has been pitted to be a wonderful kind of mom. And maybe not in the sense of like a good mom, but a wonderful character of
We're
a
mom.
We're
looking at you, Schitt's Creek. That's the name of the show.
I would say even like from Beetlejuice.
Yeah.
Questionable.
That's where
Questionable.
I was going. Mind you, not a great mom, mm-hmm. but a great mom character.
Yeah, love her character. Would not want her for my mom. This is from Beetlejuice.
I mean, not even from Home Alone?
That's different.
I mean, she leaves her kid at home.
I know. That's pretty neglectful.
She was a great mom character, though.
Oh, yeah. Great mom character.
Yeah.
We have to make sure we put that space there. Great mom character. Yeah.
Pause,
not great mom
that
character.
That pause is just the...
Yeah. A great mom does not forget their child.
No. But she probably does in IRL. So we're here for you, Catherine.
I mean, also a couple highlights. Wendy McLendon Covey, who played Gail. I feel like Gail was another fun character to see. She was the big cloud who worked in HR for the city. She was fun. She was very boisterous. Her voice, compared to how she looks, is very like strong energy, very much like upfront. She's very headstrong in the role, and it resonates really well. She definitely personifies that really well as the character. So she does a really great job. Was there anybody else that anybody saw that I wanted to that you wanted to highlight before I go any further?
Oh, I wonder why I know her. She's Beverly Goldberg from the Goldbergs.
Yay! Wendy.
Really?
Yeah,
Wendy. Ah. She's also from Reno 911. Not gonna lie, I knew Wendy before the Goldbergs.
Man, she's got a film history.
She does.
You're doing great, Wendy.
This cast, we can say vocally, this cast is small enough that the characters themselves are even more memorable. And the voice acting makes it that they are memorable. Like, yes, we are literally going into a Zootopia-esque environment, but your cast of characters is so small where you get in, you hone in, and you're like, I like that guy or I like that one. Like, there's the people in the bodega that are in Firetown. There's the bouncer at the door for the water tower. There's Mr. Fern, what is it, Grouchwood?
Yeah.
That's a supervisor. There are so many characters, but the cast still remains small, and it's simultaneously very large and very small.
Well, and we're missing one other particular key character, and that's the mom, Cinder, mm-hmm. who's played by Shaila Ami, who is an Iranian actress who does a phenomenal job in this role as somebody who is wanting to see their daughter succeed and find love, because she is apparently a love doctor of sorts, or who can tell she can tell the match, like how strong the match is between two people based on their
smoke. Their incense.
I have a question. That was her mom?
That was her mom.
Who'd you think it was?
I thought it was a grandma.
No, that's her mama.
No, that's Bernie's wife.
Oh, Spencer.
Okay, interesting.
Oh, Spencer. Okay, can't be mad at you.
That's the mom.
Okay.
She was pregnant with Ever when she got off the boat.
Oh yeah. I like how I did not clock that. He's at like all.
The grandma had a baby really late. Does it's really weird that the her son took over. No, she's a really great actress, and I found her very enduring. I thought, in going back to like great mom characters, she is a great mom character in this particular film. And she really does resonate that whole mentality of, you know, my daughter's needs first before everything else, even though I perpetuate this mindset that we have to do what your dad says kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which definitely is shown in this film. Talking about the story, this is the biggest surprise for a lot of people, because a lot of people look at the film and they're like, oh, it's just about elements, or it's just, it's a zoo, like Amy said, it's a Zootopia type setting.
A Zootopia type love story.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah. But in all honesty, this movie really does give us more to that, you know, that whole credence that, you know, what is unseen is probably the most valuable. And in this particular film, knowing after the fact that Peter Son put his own story into this film and created an outlet to love on his folks, love on his family, and show that honor and parentage, it shows in spades. Mm-hmm. Like, without a doubt, this movie is so heart-filled and just honestly, it's a surprise. Every time I run into someone, and before I saw the film, I would be like, ah, oh, yeah, I'm going to go see Elemental. Yeah, whatever. And everyone would resonate that whole mindset. Like, they would repeat that, you know, mirror that. And then I would tell them, oh my God, did you see Elemental? And they're like, no, why would I go see that? I'm like, no, you don't understand. You have to see Elemental. There's a sense of pride in the fact that I've seen it now, because number one, we get a chance to share in the story that Peter Son has expressed through this film. But also number two, it is a great story to tell. Mm-hmm. People have this experience. America is technically the melting pot of the world, and it's filled with millions and millions of immigrant stories that have yet to be told. And we get a chance to see somebody such as Peter Son, who has been in the industry for a while. We've seen him as a voice actor in several films. We saw his directorial debut with, you know, The Good Dinosaur. And now we get a chance to see his, you know, his sophomore directorial film, which is this one. And in major feature film,
I hear you on that. And it's also needs to be acknowledged that he wasn't the only one that wrote this piece. The screenplay was also done by John Hoberg, who was a writer for Black-ish, My Name is Earl, Better Off Ted, Kate Leichel, who also worked on some of the same pieces as John Hoberg, and then Brenda, and I believe her last name is Sue, and this is her first film writing credit.
Yeah.
So between that, and then on top of that, you have Peter Son. And it is a wonder to see them kind of all create this beast that continually moves forward.
Well, and a lot of it is like with the writers that you mentioned, you know, you have a lot of people who have care and sensitivity towards the minority story. I mean, you take a look at Black-ish, and Black-ish is exactly that. You know, seeing somebody of, you know, the African-American community come up and become somebody successful and carry that success as a Black family, you have to have that kind of care coming into a story where it's essentially Peter Son's, you know, coming to America story. Mm. And you can't have somebody's like, all right, and in this one, we're going to have somebody throw a pie at his face. And in this one, we're going to have somebody show up who's got slanted eyes and going to do X, Y, and Z. Like, there was none of that. There was care and consideration brought to this story to create a tale that resonates easily. It doesn't take a lot to take a story like this and immediately get derailed.
Yeah, very true. You know,
we've seen it with like take for instance the stories between like Coco and the Book of Life. Coco is one. They're essentially both the same story in a sense.
Overarching story.
But at the same time, you look at the Book of Life, which sadly was directed by Guillermo del Toro, but the movie has a little bit more looseness when it comes to like casting and the story elements and so forth, Whereas Coco takes...
It wasn't Guillermo del Toro that directed Book of Life.
I thought it was.
It was George R. Gutierrez.
So then what did Guillermo del Toro do for that one?
He probably was an exec on it, which makes sense.
True.
But that's, yeah, that's, I was like, hold up, we're not going to...
I don't want to besmirch
his name. He's a producer on the Book of Life.
Okay, so it was a producer. He was attached to it. The idea, though, that you take Coco, which honors the heritage and the traditions of the Mexican culture, creates opportunities and roles for individuals of Latin descent to step into roles that would help just intensify the ingrained attachment to this tradition. And then you set them on a journey that allows them to explore their own heritage compared to, you know, Channing Tatum going to, you know, it's just, there's
compared to Channing Tatum doing what?
Channing Tatum's the lead role in The Book of Life.
Oh, I haven't seen that movie.
Second
Sorry.
One. The other guy's the guy.
Diego Luna.
Yep.
Yeah. Mm. But the lead role is Channing Tatum.
Diego Luna is the main role in Book of Life. He's the one that dies and he's the guitar player and the singer. Channing Tatum is the matador.
Well, there you go.
As someone who hasn't seen The Book of Life, it sounds very similar.
Because Ron Perlman play is not female death. He's the...
Your guess is as good as mine.
No, I just remember because he looks like Discord from My Little Pony. I'm sorry, Ron Perlman. I'm sorry. Who's played by Q in My Little Pony. So that's for you, Spence.
John DeLancey?
Yeah. Which, mind you... My tiniest human is like, Discord, he's my favorite. And I was like, oh, girl, wait till you see him IRL. We show you some Star Trek. That'll be great.
Yeah, Diego Luna, Zoe Saldana, Ron Perlman, Channing Tatum, Christina Applegate, Ice Cube, Danny Trejo, Carlos Alazac. I've never learned how to pronounce his last name. Carlos Alazraque, the voice of what's his name? Main voice actor for most of our childhood.
Oh, you mean Rocco from Rocco's Modern Life?
Yeah.
What?
He's also he's Panchito in the new DuckTales.
How it took Rocco's Modern Life to like be like, oh, I know that.
It's Hefa. I know
Hefa.
That was really good.
But I say all that to say, like, it takes a group of strong, engaged, and invested writers to truly create a tale that resonates on all aspects. And when you have a story such as this that requires the connection to not only the minority community, but also the mindset of, you know, people who understand the differences between minorities. Because essentially, this is a story about Peter Sons, you know, coming to America story, coming from Korea. It doesn't say South or North.
It's South. So quick backstory on Peter San. His parents immigrated from South Korea in the late 80s. His dad came with $150 in his pocket. Oh, he spent, and to quote Peter San, his dad spent $75 on a hooker hotel. That is exactly the quote. I'm not even joking. And then he rented a hot dog cart from, as his dad said, the Greeks. I'm not joking. This is literally all print and I'll send you guys everything on it. And he sold hot dogs, slushies, and pretzels in downtown Manhattan until he had enough money. And then they started slowly building up until he got to the fruit and vegetable stand or the fruit and vegetable store. And Peter San talks about that there's lots of elements literally in this movie where it was moments from his childhood where he came in and at one point Ember finds her father asleep at the register. And he says that he used to come in and he and his brother would find his dad literally just laying on the counter asleep. Because he was working from 4 a.m. to 11, and it was go, 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 go. And then that his mom would take them to the movies, and it was like his mom chose not to really learn a lot of English, which created a kind of barrier. So Peter and his brother were like the translators, but they take their dad, and their dad would fall asleep anywhere. So like he was working so much and they were doing this, and it was actually what created Peter's passion for animation was watching movies and just being kind of absorbed in that. But there's lots of literally the relationship between Ember and Wade is based on Peter and his wife. I can't remember if it's Anna or Ann Chambers, who is a white artist at Pixar, when they fell in love, and his fear about them not being able to connect and that his mother would be totally against it. And then, like, there's so many things in this film where Peter Doctor was saying that this
Pete Doctor.
Well, here's the thing, and I'm not pushing up my glasses, but you're going to hear it in my voice. Pete Doctor says everyone calls Peter Pete, but Pete Doctor was a producer on the story, and he said that it was literally Peter San. It was San everywhere across it. It was moments where there's this impish playfulness, or there's somebody over here that's experiencing, he's going to not only tell you how he's feeling, but how you make him feel, and then he's going to show you. So essentially, it's Peter San on film in a more, I can't say organic way, but it's just literally a smattering of him everywhere.
Everywhere.
Sorry, you look like you were kind of going to say something, Eddie, but then you kind of stopped. So I don't know how to help. But this story is twofold. I think for me, I picked up on the immigrant story from the trailer, but Spencer, you had said it was a love story.
Yeah, that was the thing that, like, just screamed out at me. And I was like, oh, okay. So, like, being hit with an immigration story, I was like, oh, okay, like, let's do this instead for a while. Because while it was still going, I was like, oh, so we're going to transition into that. That seems very interesting. And, yeah, like, Pixar has always had, like, a really, I want to say this, deft touch at, like, being able to pick up sensitive subjects and really explore them. Mm-hmm. And, like, even listening to your story, I was like, you know, like, I'm really just glad that Pixar will go the lengths to, like, make personal stories like this, because they come out like just really authentic, you know?
Yeah.
Well, and you, if you have somebody like Pete Doctor attached to it, especially as a good friend to Peter San, the Pete Doctor has made a name for himself within the Pixar universe for coming out with directing Monsters, Inc., you know, directing Up, directing Inside Out, where if there ever was a heart-wrenching, like, completely breaking you down to tears moments in Pixar history, it's Bing Up bong. And everything in Inside Out.
Which is, and fun thing, because Peter San's talked about his first animating gig was the fish tank inside of the dentist office in Finding Nemo. Mm-hmm. And then the next one that he ended up doing was the fight between Mr. Incredible and Mrs. Incredible in The Incredibles, where he's like, you can't go with me. She's like, why can't you? Then he goes, because I can't lose you again. He animated that entire thing. Oh. So that's all Peter San. But when it comes to Up, you remember that brilliance where all the balloons had opened right before when his house is about to leave? Mm-hmm. All of that is Peter San. That entire thing. He storyboarded it. And Pete Doctor goes, it's literally shot for shot his storyboards. That moment when the house has all the balloons that build up and open and it starts floating away and it's a little girl. And I'm like, that's like the best thing you need after those first like 7 minutes of just murder on your soul.
Well, and if you look at animation, like, Pete Doctor has a lengthy history within the animation community, because if you go back to the very first Pixar film, which was Toy Story. Pete Doctor actually directed the short Jerry's Game, and that was done before Toy Story. He animated that. As well as, you know, an assistant animator on Bugs Life. He was part of the animation. He was the animation director for James and the Giant Peach.
Aww.
And it goes to show, like, Pixar is very big on giving opportunities within their team, especially if they show promise. And Peter San has been somebody who has been showing that for years. And to see not only his efforts in the film that I have yet to see, The Good Dinosaur, but to see his efforts in this movie really kind of solidify his ability to direct heart-filled stories and engaging storytelling. You know, it's one of those things where it's like, I don't think this is going to be the last time we're going to see Peter San direct anything.
And I think just to pop back to The Good Dinosaur.
Oh, by the way, I'm sorry. He also directed
Peter Doctor.
Pete Doctor. Yeah. He directed Soul.
Oh, yeah.
And like Soul was another one that was like, oh, my God, this movie. Like, as a musician myself, and Spencer, I'm pretty sure you can resonate, Soul just crushed your soul. Like, there was every part of it that was like, oh, my God, I don't think I could watch this again.
Well, and that was that. There's something to be said about the three movies that did not get their due in theater.
Yeah.
Like, and I think that's part of the thing that we need to kind of address with Elemental. And at first I need to address the dinosaur in the room. The Good Dinosaur, joke, was considered to be actually one of Pixar's biggest flops.
Yeah.
And so it's...
But it goes back to exactly what they did with Elemental. They didn't promote it like
they
properly.
They didn't promote it. They had a situation where Peter San was actually going to be co-directing with, I think, Bob Peterson was his name, and they removed him. And so Peter San, it was like he was given 18 months to rework and refinish the entire thing and do it. And so he's talked about, like, I had PTSD. And mind you, he had done a short, which was so delightful and sweet. And then he did this. And so it's considered to be one of Pixar's biggest flops, but it's beautifully rendered. It's lovingly designed. It's earnest in what it's trying to do. And then when we get to Elemental, right now, in comparison to the last Pixar that was in theaters, which was Onward,
yeah,
it has made less than Onward. And that's something to be said.
Because but then Onward did come out directly to Disney Plus as well. I don't remember Onward having a theatrical debut.
No, it was in theater.
Because we reviewed it, and it was in theater right before shutdown.
I thought...
Nope. So we had Onward was the last one that was in theaters, and then we had that giant gap where Soul, Luca, and Turning Red were all on streaming. Which, firstly, that is a crime, and I swear I can get on a very large hill, and I can beat my drum all day about the injustice... And the care that those flipping movies needed to be in a theater. But I won't because we've already beat that drum. And then we're coming to Elemental, which was entirely underplayed. It's been entirely undermarketed. And there's no way for them to get any type of a hook to this movie that makes people as excited as they should be about this.
And also, just so we know, Onward came out March 6, 2020.
Thank you.
So it was right before.
Yeah.
And to be quite frank, I, as somebody who's in marketing, I don't think there's a way you can market this film without giving away the best parts of the reveal, if you will, of the film. Because I mean, even if you go to the extent of creating a marketing plan that really hinges on, okay, this is an immigrant story, this is a blah blah blah, this is Peter San's personal, you know, love letter to his family, things like that, it then draws a very specific kind of crowd that will only see it because they're expecting X, Y, and Z. And if they're coming in expecting X, Y, and Z, and it doesn't quite hit that mark, then they're gonna be like, oh, Peter San was, you know, capitalizing on, you know, the immigrant community to try to come and see it, and it didn't really hit certain niches. Because technically it is an immigrant story, but it's not about the first generation immigrant. It's about the second generation. It's about those who are raised in a first generation household. And there's not really a way to market that. Unless you're like, hey, if your parents came to this country illegally, or if they came over on, you know, some facet of a way where, you know, they really struggled and you just wanted to get away from them, we got a movie for you. Like, no, you can't really do that.
Not so much. But thinking about it, I'm like, there's a niche demographic that would be like, yes, this is for me. And you're like, what?
Like, wait a second. Hold up.
I might not be the people that should be watching this, but come watch it anyway.
And that's kind of the beauty of this story. It's the hidden gem that you come to find yourself in amongst the community of other people who have, you know, discovered this to say. It's almost like Peter San is creating his own cult classic, because in the efforts of promoting this movie and putting it out, obviously, like we've heard and like we've seen, not a lot of people are aware of the greatness of this film. But there are people who, in seeing it, sing the praises of this movie. And when they can't find anybody else who can receive that and understand it, when they do, you create that small niche community of people like, oh, did you see? I saw Elemental. Did you see? Oh, my God. Blah, blah, blah. And you create that community.
And I think I'd like to, in following that train, I think we needed to talk about Peter Sahn's summer job on Brad Bird's The Iron Giant.
Yep.
Because The Iron Giant, no joke, it was the sleeper. It bombed in the box office. It was not received. And then comes out on VHS. And you cannot stop this beautiful beast of a movie.
I don't want to toot my own horn, but I went to the theaters to see that movie.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Ooh, you cool guy.
I saw Vin Diesel in metal form on the big screen.
Which we liked him in metal form, let's be very honest.
I am bought.
But that's like, I think that's part of that hallmark of making films for the people that are there that want to tell those stories, because they are going to touch people. Yeah. And Peter Sahn's there, even in all of his other characters that he's voiced, then they're not just niche, they're beloved. Like, for crying out sakes, the man looks like Russell. They based Russell and Up on this man. And it's not even like a joke. Like, and they talked again, I'm going to send you this article, because it was just, it's so in-depth and so wonderful. And it talks about that when he was caricatured, like when
the character was based on Peter Sahn.
No, I mean like an actual caricature. So the animators, they carried on this Disney tradition where they would make sketches of each other and kind of like, ha-ha, jokey joke. He's drawn as a thumb with like a thumbs up thumb with a hat and these big goofy, like wide-eyed expression. Like he's the can-do, they've called him guileless. Like, he's not just naive. He's there with optimism and wonder. And it's something that in this movie you see, especially from Ember. Like, Wade is surprised, but Ember is in sheer delight, even though she's aware of what the stakes are as her being a fire, as being a fire type. We're going Pokemon now. Being a fire type.
Oh, my gosh.
You either knew that or it was going to be Avatar. Don't lie. And I was not going to call them Avatar. But being that she's a fire element, still sounds like Pokemon, that there are these moments where she knows what the stakes are. But having those, the Wisteria sequence, the going to the movie sequence, the dinner, the crying game, not the movie.
Oh, wait, we need to talk
about yes, that. Yes, talk about the crying game.
I
have a
side story about this. So I took my mom to see this movie.
Mm. Yeah.
And we had a great time. However,
you know what? Your mom really does seem like a Brooke type. Like, your mom
is
just... That's
Wade's mom's name.
Wade's mom. Yeah. That's your mom in water form.
You know what? Yeah. No, I'll agree with that. I'll co-sign that. Because, and here's why I'll co-sign that. During the specific crying game scene, when Wade says, 1979, my mom, like, next to me, she laughs. And I'm like, what? So at the end of the movie, I was like, hey, why didn't you laugh during the movie, during the crying game? She was like, I was about to cry. I was like, Mom, that doesn't mean anything to you.
Your mom is so sweet and so, like, kind-hearted. I feel like she would fit into that water family.
Oh, definitely.
Like, his mom is absolutely the sweetest woman. That makes a lot of sense. Your story.
It does.
But that's like, I think that also kind of encompasses that story that Ember, I don't even remember why she ends up there. Oh, because they're waiting for the call to make sure that the shop doesn't get shut down.
The call from Gale.
From Gale. And so
the glass.
They go upstairs. She's introduced to the family. Like, Wade's making kind of like not concessions, but like making sure she doesn't get wet. And then when they're like, we're going to play the crying game. And everyone's like, yes, the crying game. Mm-hmm. And literally you say one word and people are just bawling. And it's so hilarious. Like, it has just an earnesty about it where there are people that are just going to cry at the drop of a hat.
Well, and it's great to be able to create.
Butterfly. Half a butterfly.
What's great about this movie is there's not a hard line for where these the expectations for a certain element group to stand by. Like, okay, all water type people are X, Y, and Z. All, you know, earth or what are they called?
They're dirt. Earth. They're not land and they're not dirt. They're earth.
Yeah.
Like, they're not all one type, and fire, they're not all one type. Like, this movie gives you an opportunity to really see the multifacetedness of individuals within a world that could be placated with the mindset that, oh, everybody of these certain types carry certain traits. They're all like this. Yeah. All the water people are snobbish and, you know, artistic. And I mean, let's call a spade a spade. The water people are white. You know, and
there's a heavy implication that they're most likely white. They are very affluent.
And they are.
And they're wishy-washy.
You know, I
know, Spencer, come on.
Oh my God. We're going to have to limit your puns in these episodes coming up. But I feel like Peter Son does a great job of directing these particular characters to be multifaceted, to where you wouldn't expect somebody like Wade to be instantaneously recognized as a sensitive being, as an individual who has a deep concern and care for the people around him. He is literally giving citations and crying at the same time that he has to give citations.
Your dad did this.
Your dad did all this. I'm going to have to cite him for this. And it's like, who are you?
No, like, I remember the first time he was like writing citation, I was like, is this actually happening? Is this a joke? What is this guy? Because it was very hard to like get where he was coming from.
And you get to meet the rest of his family, and they're all like that.
Yeah.
Like, they all have that caring, sensitive mentality, i.e. the crying game mm-hmm. that they do. And
it's a sense of fun makes it even more hilarious. That, like, what makes them happy? We're going to make each other cry. And then if I'm crying too because you're crying, perfect. Like, it fits in this weird, literal, weird space that you're like, this shouldn't be funny. This shouldn't make sense. This shouldn't be endearing. But it's all of those things at the same time. Like, and then when you have Wade pitted against Ember and she's like, sorry, bro, it ain't happening. And you're like, oh, no. Wade's going to cry first.
Well, and then, like we said, spoiler alert, but we get to that end scene where ultimately Wade sacrifices himself so that, you know, in the situation that they are, he essentially dies to an extent in the film. And you get to a point where Ember, who has been this almost callous type person because of the way either she was expected to be or the way she thought that it was the norm for her, like other fire type individuals, other fire people are supposed to be. Those you get to a point types. To where Ember is immediately taken to the efforts of understanding her emotions and being okay to express them, as she is told by Wade several times that even in her most vulnerable places, she is still beautiful.
Yeah.
And that creates a lot of opportunities for conversation in terms of like understanding you don't need to be strong all the time.
Which he tells her.
Yeah. And I feel like that's a conversation that we fail to have on the daily for a lot of people in society today. Mm-hmm. It's okay to feel. It is okay to not be okay, I think is the overarching, you know, anthem for anybody who's gone to therapy, mm-hmm. you know, to state that it's okay to not be okay. It's okay to feel. It's okay to carry a opportunity where you can be vulnerable with people you trust. And in throughout the movie, we see Wade effortlessly give Ember several opportunities to be in a place that she can trust. And I feel like that is the type of individual, whether male, female, you know, non-binary, whomever you may be, that is the type of people you want to have surround you. You want to have people like Wade. You want to have, and that goes back to what I was saying about the voice actor carrying this very neutral, although masculine character role, a very neutral type of character persona where he is open to being sensitive. He is open to being a listening ear. He is open to recognizing his own feelings because that is how he was brought up. That is how he was allowed to be within his own home, i.e. how we see Brooke, his mom be, his family, how the rest of them embrace this mindset of vulnerability is not a state to be ashamed of. Vulnerability is a place that is healthy and should be consistently met with so that you can have the opportunities to process and give yourself the space, even if that space is within your own family, it's within your own home. And when you feel comfortable growing up in a place like that, you then feel comfortable to carry it outside the home and you give other people the opportunity. And no matter how abrasive they may be or how callous they may seem or however they may feel they are unable to meet those kind of expectations of being vulnerable, Brooke and her family and Wade create this mentality that having this type of persona is not a sign of weakness.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of fun instances where, you know, they're saying goodbye to people. And, you know, Brooke has this moment where she's like, oh, little baby, little drop, doop, drop, doop, doop, drop, and drop, she's crying. And it's funny. It's funny and it's fun and it's silly. However, they're outside the home. They're creating that safe space to be, you know, in touch with their feelings. Well, in any space.
Well, and I think one of the best representations that before we even get to meeting Wade's family is at the basketball game or whatever the game is at the Air Coliseum where mm-hmm. we're going first to meet Gail, and Wade and Ember show up because we've got all those citations and Wade's like, look, Ember, I'm going to try to help you fix this. If we can talk to Gail, maybe we can like smooth it out. And she's there to watch essentially a championship game between the Windbreakers.
Unacceptable.
It was so many fart jokes. And even I was like, whoa, that's really gaseous.
Oh, yeah. And the Crop Dusters. That's
the Crop Dusters and the Windbreakers. There you go.
And there was even a point where they were keeping score on based on passing gas.
Yeah. So
a lot of fart jokes.
It was a lot of fart jokes. Too many. And I was just like, woof. But we get to the point where their main player, whose name is Lutz, and literally Wade realizes he's like, they're talking and everybody's angry around him. And Gail's like, well, he's not doing a good job. And Wade's like, well, he had a hard time. Feel bad for him. And initially you're like, and then he just screams out, we love you, Lutz. And he gets everybody to start cheering. And then he does the wave, which is probably one of my favorite. We're like, okay, that's really cool. And you see all of these water people literally make a wave around the entire Coliseum. And it reinvigorates and inspires the guy. And it gives that space where the emotions are not only acknowledged, but they're actively, the community comes to and rallies around to support, and it lifts literally the entire Coliseum.
I mean, in all honesty, we recognize that having this type of persona can be a support and not a hindrance to individuals in the community, just in your general community. There's no shame in wanting to cheer up your fellow friend. There's no shame in recognizing, you know, if somebody's having a hard day, to say, hey, you can do this. You got this. Like to continually be recognized, be aware and recognizing, you know, that some people who are going through a hard time just need a little bit of support, a little bit of, hey, you got this. And I think that's what Wade carries. And it's
genuine.
It is very genuine.
It's earnestly genuine. It helps turn Gail and creates a more compassionate Gail towards Ember. And it builds this entire space of, yes, things are bad right now, but it will be okay. Like it is a testament to the unbridled optimism and good natured spirit that is Peter Son. Like, ooh, I gotta save some of these for the end when I do my thingy. So
let's talk about highlights or issues. Were there any highlights or issues that you guys wanted to talk about in this film? I can go first.
Safety. Go first. If I get one of yours, either of you, then I can just pull back and find something else.
One of my issues, and it's very minimal, but one of my issues was I didn't quite understand how the land people
who are so severely underrepresented in this.
They're barely in this movie.
That was awkward.
They really are. But like the scene where we see them pruning each other,
and they're pulling apples. They're off pulling each
apples
other?
Off I each didn't other. Get that and I'm joke. Like, I don't get it. Like,
did you get it?
No.
Okay.
Like, because like you don't say, you know, I'm going to go pick some apples for any type of thing besides picking apples. So like I don't know.
And I'm like, are they just trimming each other's hair? Or like is it like a haircut that they're doing?
Biology brain says it's not. Biology, if we get in the nitty gritty, says it's not because of what fruit represents.
Well, I don't think it's that.
I think it is that.
You really do.
Because they like are looking heck, they're like, just pruning. And you're like, why are you acting so skeevy about it?
So are you saying that this was like elemental foreplay?
Freaky deaky.
I think, yeah.
Freaky deaky.
Spencer's what, like, yeah.
Because, yeah. And the way that they lingered was just a little aggressively I just, too plus, long. Plus, like,
you're not going to let just anyone prune you. That seems like an intimate thing.
Good point.
Who knows? It just it didn't really quite make sense, that particular joke, and the fact that it was in the trailer, and I had been thinking about it for quite a while because it was in the trailer, and I'm like, what the heck does this mean? What pruning are we talking jokes? About?
Pruning.
So I felt like that joke fell a little flat, and because of that was like part of my expectation for the land people. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, do they prune often? Or is this something is this something we should be worried about? And like, is there like an overgrowth of like land people that, you know, like rabbit kind of thing? Like, are they like grabbing the apples, throwing it on the floor and planting it and be like, ah, oh, that was good for me. Was it good for you? Like, how does that work?
See, that just leans into that. That's definitely what that was then.
See, and like that one, I'm just, again, I'm like, I don't know what this means.
Peter San, you dirty man. does anybody else have, I mean, of course, highlights in terms of me, like obviously everything that they did in this film was a highlight. I felt like every aspect of what they created, honestly, I feel like one of the highlights that I don't think is talked about often is the instant like understanding that water and fire can mix. Because according to chemistry, there is something called the Leidenfrost effect, which...
Oh, get real in here, chemistry nerd.
Well, I mean... I'm,
spell it out for all us non-chemistry folks.
Leidenfrost. Leidenfrost.
Oh, literal spelling. There you go. No, yeah, I meant literally, like, tell us what it is. But I liked your spelling. Fun.
The Leidenfrost effect is the fact that when you have high temperatures and water, it doesn't necessarily create... a immediate like gaseous effect. In certain instances, depending on the temperature of the water will actually glide over the hot surface, because underneath the water, as it's touching the hot surface of whatever it is, there is a layer of gas that is instantly created underneath that creates a barrier between the hot surface and the liquid. It also does it with ice as well. But what happens sometimes is that it'll allow the liquid to remain on the hot surface for a good amount of time because of that barrier. Think of like a buffer, a layer of air, of instant steam that is underneath and allowing it to essentially glide over the hot thing. So immediately, as soon as I saw this movie, I'm like, oh, they'll be fine. Leidenfrost effect, it'll be good. Get it done.
I like how you just were watching this and you're like, oh, science, you're fine. Don't worry about it.
This works. But the fact that I feel like there's got to be some kind of chemist out there. There's got to be some kind of science nerd who's on YouTube and like, of course this movie makes sense because, you know, Leidenfrost effect and, you know, blah, blah, blah. This is that. Oh, you know, they were meant to be together. This is the next evolution of relationships in Kintsevisuke, whatever. That was just me. I don't know. Highlight. Amy, what about you?
Highlights. I have to go last because Spencer needs to have things to talk about.
Oh, well, just because you stole all the last.
It wasn't
Amy. Okay. Oh, good.
No,
Spencer.
So I will highlight, even though we already talked about them, Waits family, because, man, I like those people. Even though they are kind of weird and very emotional, like, they just made Wade make so much more sense to me. Mm-hmm. And it was just fun getting to spend some time with them.
Do you have any issues? True.
Actually, not really.
Really?
Wow. Not that I can really like.
Apparently, Amy has a list. So
ooh, I want to see your list.
No, I was just, I was like,
she goes, really? Really? You didn't find anything wrong? And like, she's going to, yeah, drop it like it's hot.
I mean,
no pun intended.
I don't really have any, like, issues I feel are, like, worth talking about. Like, the apples thing is probably, like,
just the weirdest,
like,
one.
The major thing I feel like, yeah, in this movie. Everything else is, like, so minor.
Amy!
Okay.
Lay it on us. Here she goes. I told you she had a list.
So issues.
List.
Issues.
Issues.
The background. So this is both a wonderful issue and a wonderful highlight. The background had so many things going on, I couldn't focus. Which is great and horrible at the same time.
So is this both or?
It's about, this is
okay,
the both.
Okay.
Because the issue of it is like, there's so much going on. There's so much happening that you're like, oh, there's other things in the back. Oh, there's signs over there. I should probably read those. Those seem like, you know, there's more Easter eggs than just Easter eggs that are hidden back there. So that became slightly frustrating, but also slightly wonderful because I could appreciate it. Claude. We didn't talk about homie Claude.
Because he's barely there.
I needed more Claude. I needed Claude hitting on more people at the end of the. If Claude, let me back it up. Claude is a literal dirt clod of a dude that's like, hey, Ember, look at me. I'm growing. I'm sprouting. And he like legit pulls out a daisy from his armpit that he's sprouted. And he's like, m'lady. Like, I loved that this is the kid that would be around everybody's, like, that you see almost as a trope that he's around the block. He's hitting on our main character girl. And she's like, no, you're too young for me. And he's like, I'm going to keep trying. Like, I needed more of him. He was so, it was so ridiculous, but so wonderfully lighthearted. And then the pruning joke, agreed. I was like, I still don't get this. This is weird. So yeah, for my issues, that's pretty much it on that. Now that I'm thinking about it aggressively. Highlights. I loved at the dinner table what Ember did with the broken pitcher.
Oh.
Which.
It's very Christian of you there to do that. Like the whole broken pieces put together kind of thing. It was just, that's honestly.
Christian
hey,
of me?
No, I just, in my mind, like I immediately went that direction. Cause I'm like, oh. You know, beautiful pieces, make something new. It's like, okay.
Ember's, did you jars of clay then?
Ember's Jesus. Got it. Ember's Jesus.
Wow. I didn't even get that.
I did not either.
Okay. So,
dude, I have been indoctrinated for many years. There's still outliers there that still remain in my head that just
apparently
immediately,
you're like, look at me.
Did anybody see that movie Joshua?
Jesus.
Like when he takes the broken pieces of the.
Literally, I just saw that. I was like, oh, that's pretty. Anyway.
Yes. So my thing, why that's one of the highlights for me is not only is it gorgeous when it's all done, but we see her kind of working through or working into the story where things break. She immediately, she's like, I got it. I'll fix it. And she goes to town and she makes it, like she collects all the pieces. She heats them up. She remelts them. And she just does it like without even thinking. It's second nature. And then when we see it in a completely different environment, where everybody's like, she's like, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to do this. And everybody's like, this is amazing. Do you do this often? It was this just great moment of realization that when you take things that you are really good at out of where you are and put it into a new environment, suddenly you realize, oh crap, I actually
have
people,
skill.
And people like this? Mm. And I'm good at this and it's something that I do without even kind of thinking and I'm good at it and they like it. Oh my gosh. I love. And then that Brooke shows up at the end and she's like, thank you. I have an Ember original. And I was like, oh, I was
an
like,
original
oh,
Ember. Yeah.
An Ember original.
Ember original, original Ember.
Yeah. So that's one of the things, but it sounds like you want to move on. So I'm going to just shut my yappy trap because.
I didn't say anything. Did you say something, Spencer?
I did not say anything.
You started to.
So I do want to move over to our roundtable question. And the roundtable question for this is because we have seen Peterson just continually surprise us with everything that he's been doing, whether if it's character roles or directing. The question I have for the table is, if you could hand the direction of any film franchise to Peterson as a director, What franchise would you give him?
Okay, here's what I came up with originally.
Let me guess, Transformers.
They would make you feel so much it would hurt.
You would have a squishy Transformers.
Oh, that's so weird.
I don't know if I want that. What I would give him is, before James Gunn takes over, I'd give him the DCEU. Like, the Zack Snyder version. Because just from what I've seen of DC stuff, it seems to work better when it's a bit more on the positive side than when it's just on the glower and gloom side. So,
or at least have like some base to it, some foundation of like heart and sincerity to it.
Yeah.
You know, that would actually be really good. I like that. Amy, do you have one in mind?
So I had to stop and think about this because how Peterson has approached a lot of things and what this movie means to him. I was like, I want to put him in some place where not only people are going to feel the plight of the characters in there, but actively root for them. I would like to see him take on the X-Men franchise.
The X-Men that could franchise. Work.
Because the thing is that he'd have, and it would be a balancing act, which would require him, one, to grow, but also to stay true to who he is, because I could see him directing a Kitty Pryde that breaks everybody's heart. Like, and that's...
So are you saying specifically a Kitty Pryde story, or are you talking about the X-Men in general?
X-Men in general, because you're teetering in that space of, and we get Patrick Stewart back, don't lie, Sir Patrick Stewart, come back. Like, I think that would be such a crazy and amazing way to work, even though he primarily works with animation, having live action would be a complete departure, and it would be fun.
I mean, you could just give him, like, animation still.
I know. Oh my gosh, now think about it,
Yeah, you lost that one there,
Eddie,
Chief.
I didn't lose anything. I'm winning.
I actually have three choices.
Oh, look at
so
you.
Many.
Well, I'm sorry.
Walk me off.
My bad. I mean, you went with yours. Did you have another one? Or you have
I don't
to
know,
think
Coco, how about you tell me?
Oh, no. honestly, there's three options. So I would love to see him. No, God, no. What? No.
What?
That's not even...
I'm throwing him off. Keep going.
I would love to see him do, in my first thought, I would love to see him continue the Cornetto trilogy. I would love to see him do another Simon Pegg, you know, another, you know, moving forward in that universe that Edgar Wright started. I would love to see him take on that and move it forward. My other thought was that I would love to see Peterson take on, going back to the Cornetto trilogy, I feel like there's a lot of heart and humor in there that Edgar Wright has specifically created for that film franchise that I feel with Peterson's efforts and sincerity, because if you watch all those films, there is heart at the center of all of those movies. Mm-hmm. And he actually makes those films funny as heck, but at the same time makes you yearn for like resolution and care for the characters that you're watching. It's not just like, oh, well, they're all expendable, so whatever. I would also like him to take on the Addams Family series.
I feel would like be so good.
He would do really good in that effort of creating the characters to have heart. We would go back to the Raul Julia type frame of mind, where the sincerity but zaniness of those characters would be revisited, and I feel like he could do those well. My final thought, and I feel like this would earnestly become a very possibility, I would love to see him continue the Guardians franchise. I feel like he could essentially add that humor that James Gunn has. There's already a lot of heart already established within this franchise.
True.
He can build on that. He can. I mean, we've seen in this last one, I don't think we've cried in all of them more than this last one. But I feel like Peterson could add more to that and build on the heart that's already created with the new Guardians that we have, what we were left off with in the last film. And honestly, I just want to see Peterson stretch, and I want to see him do things that he would, in all honesty, on paper, probably wouldn't make sense to do, but knowing him and his capability, he could ultimately give us something gold. And I feel like that's the arena that we could find him in. So, but wrapping this whole thing up, let's go ahead and go around the table, talk about whether or not the film passes or fails, and how many monocles, and starting with Amy.
You're going to mess yourself up by doing this because everybody's going to have to follow me. All right. This film passes, if you even guessed, if it wasn't going to. Shocker. Surprise.
All right, Spence.
Elemental is a thank you to Peter Sohn's hardworking, culture-clashing parents, and it embodies everything that makes him wonderful. It has heart. It has feelings. And at the end of the day, if you are not feeling something, I question if you need to talk to somebody or otherwise, and I would highly suggest it. While Peter's parents did not live to see this movie completed, it is a true testament to an amazing human that was raised by incredible parents. So for me, I'm giving it a 4.5 out of 5 monocles.
Why a 4.5?
Because I didn't cry as much as I do in Coco. Coco's my benchmark for sobbing.
Okay.
But that's about it.
That makes a lot of sense.
Literally, I cried the entire third act of Coco, and this one got me in different places. Spencer.
Gosh.
You dirty
Spencer,
man.
Does the film pass or fail, and how many monocles?
This movie passes. It's a really wonderful film. Like, it was a lot of fun just to watch and get to explore this world. And really, I wasn't expecting any great story, but I'm really glad it was told, like I said earlier. So for me, I'm going to give it a 4 out of 5.
Wow. There you go. Obviously, duh. The film passes for me. I absolutely adored this film. It was a genuine surprise and delight watching this film from the first act all the way to the last act. Being able to honestly be overwhelmed by the true sincerity that Peter Sohn, as a director and as a human, put into this film. I can't help but not congratulate this man on creating one of the most modern tales of the immigration story that we have seen in a long time. We haven't seen a lot of that as of late. I mean, you know, there's A Bronx Tale. There's, you know, there's a lot. I mean, being a Latino and a third generation Mexican who has family who immigrated to this country, literally living in trash. My grandfather was living in a dumpster. He was living near a dumpster for a long time when he first came to the States. And then when he found my grandmother, and they were able to afford a small house in, you know, in upstate Sacramento, and being migrant workers and working in the fields. And my father and my mother, who worked tirelessly in the fields to pick cherries, pick apples, pick, you know, pick cotton, things of that sort, things of that nature, on during their summers, and to tell me and to regale those stories, and to come to a film like this and be able to say that my parents can relate to this and I can relate to this because their hard work proved to be better than where their parents left in their blessing. And I, as the third generation, am trying to do better than what they did with their blessing. It really does speak volumes. And in terms of monocles, I'm going to give it a 4.5 as well. I absolutely feel like this movie genuinely can reach across all demos. It can definitely speak to the most unattached individual who may not resonate with the story, but understand that differences make up what this world is all about. Mm. And I feel like Peter Sohn has created something special in this film. So I'm going to give it a 4.5. I really do feel that if you, much like myself, come from a family like that, or come from a background where, you know what, the idea of being a part of a nation that you have moved to and have ownership of seems like a somewhat far off dream because of the way your grandparents or your parents may have lived, and you're fighting for that American dream, I have to say that this movie is for you. This movie really does speak to a level that you can't just personify in words. You have to put it into a medium that truly translates. And I feel like Peter Sohn absolutely translated that with this film. So, but yeah.
And Thomas Newman, who does the composer, who did the music. Oh my gosh.
You see that, Spence? She still had to get the last word. But that about wraps up another awesome episode of the Filmlosophers. Again, we thank you for listening. And if you want to catch more of our episodes, head on over to our website at filmlosophers.com. There we have allegedly over 300 episodes, everything from action, anime, comedy, animation, even conversations about the industry. If you're looking for it, we got it. Head on over to our website at filmlosophers.com. You can also catch us wherever podcasts are streaming, and that's iTunes, Google Play, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Stitcher,
Spotify,
Pandora, TuneIn, or iHeart. You can tune into your heart's desire. Find us there. Look for us at The Filmlosophers. Give us a follow or subscribe and listen in. If you like what you hear, give us a 5-star review. We've earned it.
We have.
Beep boop, yes.
Okay. you can also check us out on the socials over at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101. There we post all of our hijinks as well as all of our extra content such as Spencer's Big Score and Amy's Jane Unseen, which can be found where?
The only place it's ever lived, which is at Jane Unseen on Instagram and Instagram only. And if you're wondering about the latest Jane Unseen, it is the entire episode of the Sharknado. I don't know what's six? It's not a trilogy, it's a something.
It's a saga.
There you go. Yeah,
the saga, like the Twilight saga.
Oh, no. Don't bring that up because I'll make you watch it for my birthday.
Nope.
Yep.
Anyways, again, we want to throw out our thoughts and prayers to the family of Curtis Fisher. We want to make sure that if you have the opportunity to head on over to Video Game Bang over on Twitch or find them on wherever podcasts are streamed. We will be promoting a tribute episode to him. In the near future, just keep your eyes open and your ears peeled. Or is it the other way around? Ears open, eyes peeled.
Yeah.
So, but again, that about wraps up another awesome episode. Thank you for listening. We really do appreciate it. And we hope to hear you, see you again next week. Maybe.
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 Maybe. Maybe.
No, we'll be there next week. Let's hope they are. So, from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I am Eddie.
I'm Spence.
Still intern Amy.
Class dismissed.